quite intelligent and charming. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what we've been doing in California as a result of the information that's been presented earlier. A lot of us in the state have been thinking about infertility and PID and discussing a lot about some of the limitations that exist that we've now presented to you. So as a result, there was a statewide working group related to PID surveillance that was convened. And just to give you an idea, to reiterate some of the prior findings, in California, PID is a reportable condition, but as we've seen, it's not frequently reported. As care has moved from inpatient to outpatient, we don't believe that passive surveillance has caught up. And there's also a lot of issues with confusing case definitions with no lab component, making surveillance particularly challenging. So one approach that we thought about was the idea of sentinel triangulation. Like the work that Brad and Joan has presented, there's ways to utilize existing administrative data sets to get an idea of how much PID is going on. Additionally, we do have the luxury of having PID as a reportable condition, and although it's not reported routinely, is there a way to exploit that mechanism to improve access to trends in PID? So the idea behind the analysis I'm going to show you is there a way to identify providers that see a relatively large burden of PID in California, and then work with those providers either through technical assistance, active surveillance, or identify them as sites for pilot investigations to monitor PID as an infertility-related outcome in the state. So the surveillance working group created a 10-question survey that was sent by mail to providers in California. Our sampling frame was that the provider had to have reported at least one case of female gonorrhea or chlamydia in 2008, and the reported morbidity had to have come from one of the following counties: Alameda County, San Mateo County, Los Angeles, Contra Costa, or San Francisco County. On the paper form, we included a link to a SurveyMonkey. We created a tiny URL, so it wasn't that the provider had to type in this giant long URL that you make one mistake and you go to the wrong survey. Or the other option was to fax the paper survey back to our central office. And because we did this on the cheap, we were unable to provide any incentives for completing the survey, which likely had a significant impact in our response rate, as you will soon see. So there were several domains in our survey. We asked providers about, in the past year, how many diagnoses of PID had they made themselves, and how many of those diagnoses had they reported to the local health department. We asked the provider who in their facility was responsible for reporting. Was it the diagnosing provider? Was there an infection control nurse? Some other administrative person? We also asked about whether the provider knew that PID was a reportable condition in California. And we assessed attitudes regarding PID reporting using four questions that had corresponding Likert scale values. Providers were asked to respond whether they strongly agreed, neutral, strongly disagreed, or strongly disagreed to the following: PID reporting is time consuming, reporting PID is of little value, PID is an important issue in my clinic, and the clinical uncertainty impacts whether or not I report a case of PID. So as you can see in this picture, where our lovely assistant Sally and I spent many hours folding and stuffing letters, and there we are celebrating that they're all put in boxes for the mail. So as of 2/23/2010, we had sent out 3,531 surveys. Of those, 305 had been returned as undeliverable, and we believe that the remaining 3,226 were delivered. Our response rate is 327, which is a 10.1%, which is an epidemiologist's nightmare, but it's what we got. Of those 327, there were 283 faxed paper surveys and 44 surveys completed via the SurveyMonkey. So I'm going to give you the results of some preliminary results just from the paper fax surveys. So there was only 251 surveys here to talk about. So there are definitely some generalizability issues. With respect to how many cases of PID these providers diagnosed in the past year, the range was from 0 to 200, and the interquartile range, which is the 25th to 75th percentile, was 0 to 3. Over half of these providers had not diagnosed any PID in the past year, and 7.8% had claimed they had diagnosed 10 or more cases in the prior year. We asked compared to 5 years ago whether these providers were diagnosing more, less, or about the same number of PID cases. 38% said that they were diagnosing about the same number of PID cases in the past year compared to 5 years ago, 36% fewer, 4% said they were diagnosing more PID, and about 20% said either they didn't know or they weren't practicing 5 years ago, so there was no basis for comparison. Overall, the participants reported or diagnosed a total of 1,117 cases of PID in the past year, of which they claim 597 were reported to the local health department, or 53.4%. Among providers who diagnosed at least one case of PID, 38% did not report any to the health department. This is a graph describing the responding the responses to the four questions about attitudes. So here I combined strongly agree and agree. And the red bars represent all 251 providers who responded to the survey. The orange bar represents just those providers who diagnosed at least one case of PID in the last year. And the yellow bars represent the high volume PID providers of those who reported they diagnosed at least 10 cases. So as you can see, for the question regarding PID is time consuming, about 30% overall said that they agreed with this statement, and the proportion reporting they agreed with that increased as PID diagnoses increased. A very small percent actually agreed that reporting of PID is of little value. However, the more likely you were to see PID cases, the more likely you were to agree that this is of little use. About 40% of providers said that PID was an important issue in their clinic, and among those providers who diagnosed 10 or more cases, that number rose to approximately 85%. And then finally, overall, approximately 30% of providers said that clinical uncertainty impacts whether they will report PID or not. And those proportions were relatively stable depending on whether or not they reported any, diagnosed any PID or a large number of PID cases. 67% of providers were aware that PID is a reportable condition in California, and of those who had diagnosed at least one case of PID in the last year, 61% claimed that they knew it was reportable. We asked providers, what has the health department done that's made reporting PID easier? And the two most common answers were being able to fax case reports and the fact that there was one confidential morbidity report form that they could report multiple conditions on. We also asked the providers what makes reporting more difficult. And as you can well imagine, there were a lot more answers to this question than the prior question. There was a lot of confusion regarding the case report form. Providers were unsure where the form was supposed to go. Providers reported that the forms were not easily accessible within their clinics. Several providers report that the health department should work more closely with labs because there are chlamydia and gonorrhea is a lab reportable condition. And I put question marks there because getting back to what some of the prior speakers spoke about, PID is not a lab-based diagnosis. It's a clinical-based diagnosis. So the fact that some providers were saying that if we just work better with labs, this would go away suggests that there's a knowledge gap among providers with respect to PID. And then additionally, there were issues about time, the amount of time that was necessary to report. And several providers mentioned that they had to report things several times because fax machines were broken or not on, or they were getting error messages. So the challenges in implementing a survey of such as this nature, I think we all learned a lot as we started putting together the sampling frame. And a lot of these issues, I think, go well beyond just this with respect to PID. We have some providers who work at multiple facilities, and then we have providers who work in the same facility but in multiple services. So for example, a provider who works at Kaiser on the OB-GYN floor as well as the pediatrics floor were unable to classify exactly what kind of provider type they are. There are a number of providers whose addresses are listed as the labs, so being able to send them a survey that they're going to get may be difficult. We had a lot of discussions and I would say friendly fighting about how to properly categorize provider types. And then finally, probably the largest challenge has been the poor response rate of our survey. While our response rate is low, and these are still preliminary data, I think that there are some kernels of value that we can take away from this. First of all, I think we've identified a relatively cost-efficient means to identify some providers who diagnose a large amount of PID. And based on the analyses of Gail and Sally, you can see that just trying to identify a clinical site where you can reach out to those clinicians and work more closely is a lot more difficult than just looking at case report forms. We've also gotten several suggestions from providers for ways to simplify reporting. Several providers mentioned a web-based system, which is currently in the works in California. Several providers also mentioned mandated lab reporting, which again, I think identifies a knowledge gap in how PID is diagnosed, managed, and surveilled. And I think that the results of this study, while not generalizable, suggest that we need to do a fair amount of work on educating providers on the clinical diagnosis, management, and reporting of pelvic inflammatory disease. So I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge my colleagues in San Francisco, the state STD program, Contra Costa, Los Angeles County, San Mateo, Alameda, the California Family Health Council, and most importantly, I'd like to take a second to acknowledge Pat Blackburn, who's our IPP coordinator, who was gracious enough to help support the costs in sending out these surveys. So I'll take any questions regarding my section, and then we're going to go on to sort of a broader discussion about PID surveillance. Yes?
I'm from Pennsylvania, and we have an electronic laboratory reporting system, and we also have an electronic data reporting system for the clinics to report in, because we're a dual, like you guys are. But the biggest issue is the provider reporting treatment. And that would be very similar to a provider going in and putting in a diagnosis of PID. I think it's a struggle that we all have in surveillance to be able to collect it. We give them the tools to do it, and it's getting the change. So I applaud your efforts on this. It's
hard. Yeah, no, it's very difficult. Yes, in the back.
Hi, that was a great presentation. I just wanted to share my experience that may help to answer your low response rate. When I went to talk to the EDs about our findings with their missed PID diagnoses, at least in the big county hospital ED, it seemed like providers didn't really care about PID, and it's just kind of like a nuisance diagnosis. You know, the trauma center, and they're working up MI, and like PID is just kind of like a nuisance diagnosis. These women coming in with reproductive issues are like a nuisance, and they didn't really seem very interested in it. And I don't know if partially it might be a gender issue, because these men in the room, people. I just felt like a little bit of lack of empathy there, and I've since reached out to them to offer it a couple times to give grand rounds, and I've never heard a positive response. Whereas I also went back to our Women and Children's Hospital with the same data. They did a better job, finding the PID. They didn't have as many missed cases, and they were actually very interested, and it looked like they were going to go back. Again, the makeup of the ED providers in that hospital, where they also have OBGYNs and pediatricians, was very different. So I just it was just very frustrating, and I think it's not just an education issue, but it's just kind of a whole attitude issue towards STDs and sexual health and women's health.
I agree. Thank you.
Gail, could I add to that? Because we've also, through our SUN project, we've got population-based, we have a sample, we don't have enough staff to call them, they're not in any case. We have the same problem. We can't get reports, even though they're supposed to fill in the treatment on our CMR card, it just doesn't happen. We're hoping the new systems will allow us to take what's in the clinic data and not have the provider involved in any of this at all. But we found the same thing with our SUN stuff. We looked at fluoro quinolones. I mean, we're since 2002, we haven't been recommending fluoro quinolones. And the one area where providers are still consistently using fluoroquinolones to treat gonorrhea is urgent care centers. So to me, if we probably look, there's probably broader, knowledge gaps in those providers that are challenges for us.
The question is how to change it. Somebody comes up with that. That's the kind of magic.
Matt, and then up here. So Matt.
So you guys have, particularly in California, you guys have done really a lot of thinking about this. It's a tough problem. Have you thought at all about the possibility of somewhat narrowing what you're doing and focus on the gonorrhea, chlamydia, positive cases of PID? realize there are downsides to it. You won't miss late sequela, you'll miss late sequela, you'll miss non-metabolic monoclonal PID. But you start with a manageable number of people who are relatively completely enumerated in terms of at least the diagnosis. So, you know, you're part of the way there already, whereas working with just a clinical diagnosis, I mean, it's so non-specific.
I think just speaking, I'll speak for the group, because and if I misspeak, I think someone will let me know. But I think some of the frustration that we've had is that all of this is under the guise of infertility prevention, but we don't measure any infertility outcome. We measure chlamydia tests and chlamydia positivity. So I think while it may be easier to focus on the chlamydia gonorrhea cases, if the real goal of IPP is to do infertility prevention, I think we potentially miss a lot of infertility that we're supposed to be preventing. Does anyone?
But no matter how we, but I agree with Matt, because I think no matter how you look at it, you know, we're looking at PID. You know, we want to see PID go down as a result of our efforts. And you know, the problem we've got with just looking at all PID, we've got this huge specificity problem. We've got, you know, all the old women and everything else going on. So in some ways, just looking at that smaller group, but again, the problem we've got, at least in our state, is providers that report, the ones that are good reporters know that timely reporting is important. So they report the case as soon as they treat the patient that day in the clinic. They don't have their test results back yet. So they just feel like, I've got to report this right now, so they go ahead and report it, but then we don't know if it's going to be. And then we've got the problem with administrative data sets, is we've got, you know, ICD-9 codes, and only at Kaiser, because we have access to their OSCAR form, their pharmacy data, their lab data, and everything, that we've been able to actually link it all up and look at actually, you know, chlamydia and gonorrhea PID. So I think it's a good idea. The challenge is accessing all that information is not as easy as we thought it would be.
There's a question over here.
Yeah. Hi, Jill from Cincinnati. And I think surveilling for PID is great, and thank you guys for putting together a great challenging symposium. I was hoping would answer all the questions for me.
We just don't make the same mistakes we've done. So.
I have two questions. One is kind of in response to how do you make providers do this? And I think the problem that I see is that most people doing STD testing are not STD providers. So you've got private practice providers balancing millions of things, and they already don't screen for chlamydia. So telling them that they now have to fill out a form is putting another barrier, you know, to that process. And I know where I have worked, in the three hospitals I have worked, that everyone falls back on the lab-based reporting. And I know that's not great, but it's so I do have that as a caveat. But how can we make the providers do this? You gotta give them something for it. You're gonna need to give them an incentive, or some method of capturing. Could we go to a single payer plan with a universal health record? My, wouldn't that fix everything? Kaiser for everyone. But my other question was, if I, as a researcher, want to measure PID as an outcome, would you suggest that I use, for example, the case definition that you have, Gail, about, you know, I mean, what would you guys suggest? I was listening to what Gail said. First thing, too, is because I had the same thing. I had providers that mark PID and then treat for cervicitis, or, you know, you look at the record and it, you know, they don't, they have reported lower abdominal pain and Black American female and PID. And it's like, you know, I don't know. I don't know what to use as an outcome.
Yeah. I don't know. I think, you know, when you get into research, I'm still worried about specificity. I think if you're going to do research, you really need to do it in a very controlled environment, and you're working with providers that know what they're doing. I mean, we even have people that are not even using CDC treatment guidelines. I mean, the antibiotics I've seen that people use.
I know, 2 grams of Zithro.
You know, treat.
Yeah, 1 gram's good and 2 grams better.
Yeah. So, you know, this is just a very challenging area that we are hampered by our diagnostic capabilities, our knowledge gaps, our reporting. So I do think that, you know, who's doing PID research these days? Is there any funding for PID
research?
I know, you know,
because you're not going to be able to get endometrial biopsies or laparoscopies on these women.
Right.
And you're going to, and actually what's clinically relevant is a clinical diagnosis. In some ways I feel like it would be nice for me to be really clinically rigorous and do some sort of high expense test talking about PID, but on the other hand, how relevant is that to everybody else when the study is done? And so that's where I'm like, well, maybe, you know, the CDC strict, you know, criteria is as good as it gets.
There's a question here. This woman's been waiting very patiently.
Well, you know, I was very interested because earlier Dr. Boland talked about how adolescents, I'm also an adolescent provider, and how they've been sort of taken out of the guidelines as a special population because there's no evidence for it. And I'm just not sure there's a lot of evidence for taking them out. So when you look at the PEACH trial data, they had 200 adolescents, they had a 43% refusal rate overall. And when you look at the adolescent data, so that's just those people less than 19 years of age, on average they're 18 years of age, and 70% of the overall group of people were contracepting, which is very different from what we're seeing in our research where 20% of girls contracepting are very, very high risk. And what we also see from the PEACH trial data, if you look at it closely, while there may not be a lot of inpatient-outpatient treatment differences, what we do see is women are having really negative effects. Overall, at 84 months, 41% of women having chronic abdominal pain. And those are really serious findings. So in part, I'm worried about how we're going to survey adolescents and any thoughts you have about how you're going to do that in California, because from an infertility prevention perspective, when you look at 15-year-old girls who may have an exposure to chlamydia or gonorrhea over a really long period of time before they begin childbearing are really high-risk people. And I guess the other thing is I'm worried that as people who are concerned about PID, that we really step back and let the adolescents, the kids out there. There was also data presented at ISPDR last summer. One of my colleagues from Hopkins looked at national hospital data from emergency departments, and they looked at, while people were, they showed the sort of differential in treatment that people got, that adolescents were significantly less likely to get the care that they were supposed to get with a PID diagnosis. So I know that's a lot of stuff, but I'm really interested in how this group is going to respond to that, those kinds of things in California, maybe as a leader for the rest of us around the nation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another thought we had. I mean, as opposed to trying to get all the chlamydia, gonorrhea, PID, and everything to all women, should we try to do something well, you know, with adolescents or young women? Again, but our healthcare delivery system is so spread out now. You know, although we've had a group of adolescent providers that feel like we need to develop consortiums and better adolescent clinics. But I think that's something we've got to think about, and I mean, you're getting into talking about cohort studies so that we can really see what's going on. But I will, in fairness to the treatment guidelines, even though they're evidence-based, sometimes the evidence is based on who shows up at the meeting. So I hate to say it, I saw, you know, when we recommended adolescents to be, all adolescents had to be hospitalized. Honestly, the recommendation was based on not that there was treatment outcome data showing that they needed IV antibiotics, but they said it's a prevention opportunity to keep them hostage in a hospital to do a lot of work with all the other issues that are going on at the same time. Then different people show up, and then it was decided there's no evidence. We got very narrow in our definition of outcome, and it was only on the evidence of the treatment you're giving in terms of outcome of their PID event. So that's how it got removed. I will say, I don't know, Mal is there. I didn't hear the PEACH stuff being discussed. So the one thing that's really good about the treatment guidelines is get your stuff out in the literature, because they will not look at anything that's not been published. I mean, we do a lot of hands that go, I do this, I do this. But, you know, it's a pretty rigorous, and again, with the way healthcare reform is going, we need evidence out in the literature. So I would definitely, you know, put all your outcomes out there and get that out there, because that was not at the table. And these guidelines are coming out again in 2010, and I don't think there's a recommendation that adolescents, it kind of gives you the, you know, option if you think you might want to consider, but it's not in the category of the bulleted, got to be hospitalized for these situations.
I think we have time for one more question in the back.
Harold Weisenfeld from Pittsburgh is one of the PID researchers. But the PEACH data set, I have a number of comments. The PEACH data set, looking at adolescents, from what I recall, showed there was no difference in treatment outcomes whether you're hospitalized or what you didn't. This is restricted to adolescents. Plus, you have to rely on providers to get good counseling care once they're in-house, and there's no guarantee nationwide that actually happens with all the busy chores that have to occur on the main patient side. So, but the PEACH data set restricted adolescents showed there wasn't a difference. I'm going to shift a little bit from PID to talk about knowledge amongst the providers and how you address that. We did a study in Pennsylvania, and we published a series of papers about 5-6 years ago looking at STD care and knowledge
And what we have about a 50% response rate, but we had a medical student for 6 months basically hounding every doctor to return the survey. We got, you know, the attorney general to sign, the health commissioner to sign off on it, et cetera, et cetera. And we got a 50% response rate. And what we showed was that knowledge and as a result of that care was better if you were a female physician, a younger physician, and if you had good training in medical school and residency. So we can't fire all the male doctors. So that's out. But female doctors, we know, do a much better job than preventive health care anyways. But I think it's a call to action to go back to our medical training and say, okay, STDs have to be brought back to the forefront. You know, medical schools and residents spend so much time on heart and how to give heart and who to give heart because they don't remember that you won't need heart if you can do STD. In many cases, if you get back to good STD care. So we need to bring STD curriculum back into medical schools and residencies.
Can I just add one quick comment, and this goes back to what you were saying, Matt. As we've moved towards urine-based testing, that's going to affect the adolescent population a lot. And if we're going to miss some of these mild cases that may have really severe outcomes, I think it's just something that we need to keep in mind as test technology becomes so good that maybe we're missing opportunities to catch them up.
That and the delay of the first exam.
Yeah, and the lack of telemedicine.
Although, at least in my state, a lot of my family clinic providers, because I was concerned about this, and OBGYN said, no, we always screen when we're doing not an exam and do urine testing. And if there's any symptoms at all of abdominal pain, we then go ahead and do a pelvic. So I think we need to assess this, but at least I've been kind of told that's not an issue to worry about. And we're not going to be screening people that are,
that's people who do it all the time. The problem is in all the
people. Yeah, no, I agree.
They don't do it all the time.
Yeah, I'm sure that that's the case. Like we
family planning is going to be different than an EB.
No, I agree.
For California, our leader for the nation, I was just curious if you're tracking and talking a little on the if you're tracking ectopic pregnancies, looking at some of these same variables in that?
We want to. Obviously, our Family Pack program doesn't provide that service. You get turfed back into, you've got complicated problems, then we don't reimburse you for those things. Oh, and Kaiser, we have a very strong collaborative relationship with Northern and Kaiser. But again, ectopics are pretty rare, and again, we've had that problem of shifting, from the inpatient treatment to outpatient treatments now. But I think that's another thing we need to look at, but we also need to recognize that not all ectopic pregnancies are also related to chlamydia, gonorrhea, those type of things. But I think also the opportunity with these new medical records, again, getting the provider out of it. I've kind of given up on the providers. That might give us some opportunities to have better outcomes in the future. So I think that's a good point.
I do want to say that Delia Scholes is actually looking at ectopic pregnancy incidence in the group health cooperative data from Seattle, Washington.
Right, and just like we're exploring alternative data sources for PID, we're doing that for ectopic pregnancy too. And there was a paper that just came out that's looking at ectopic pregnancy trends and administrative data that showed a flat trend over the last 5 years.
Well, the other thing that we've been trying to document is infertility, because where's the cost in all of this? That's what the managed care people want to show, that if they're seeing that they're spending all this money, and all these in vitro fertilizations related to, missed opportunities with STDs, that could really drive a lot of policy recommendations. But again, that's another area where how do you pick up infertility, because not everyone's trying to have a baby, so you don't have to infertile or not, et cetera.
Looking at ectopics.
The bridge.
Well, and it's an easier outcome in many ways. I mean, at least to define it from a data source.
And it's such a severe life-threatening health issue too. I mean, it has gravity.
But if it's an But infertility only counts in the decision model. When you look at economic analysis of PID, it only counts if you seek care. And so you're looking at poor women and family planning clinics of color. They don't get infertility services. It's indoctrinated. It's a major health disparity. And so we're in a catch-22 here. And so unless you do an analysis that sort of says, let me project the number of people that would be seeking services, it's a really hard thing to do infertility, because I think you've got a huge population of people who are greatly impacted by STDs.